Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 127, with guests, Real World Theology's very own Mark Wingarter, and also first-time guest of the show, who you can find at Rendaria.com, Jason Potnick. So listen up, because we've got an action-packed show for you. On this episode, we talk John Wick, Chapter 2, and the importance of purpose.
Welcome to the podcast about you.
Yeah, exactly. I thought we were talking about murder machines tonight. Like,
yeah, we are. We're talking about Jason, the murder machine.
Yes.
Well, I mean, so when did you, in this journey, pick up your love of film? Or is it just like you just always really like head into the movies?
Well, I've always been a big movie fan. It was, growing up, it was one of the things that my mom and my grandfather liked. My grandfather never went to the movies, but like I remember times in my life where I got to go to grandpa's house on a Saturday night and stay up late with him and watch like horror movies and stuff and stay the night with grandpa. And that was really cool. And my mom was really, really liked movies as well. And, I remember like when my mom chaperoned my first date when we went to go see like Back to the Future 2 or something like that. And, I've always loved movies. And I've always loved books as well. Like anything that it's telling a good story. I just love good stories. As I got older into high school, I really got into I got into Dungeons and Dragons and reading Lord of the Rings and all that stuff on the book side. But I also had a couple really good friends in high school and in college where like, it was Star Wars and anything epic. And my best friend at the time, he actually was a waiter, and the guy who ran the special sneak preview showings for every movie would come into his restaurant and would tip with tickets to the latest movie. And so like everybody always fought over who was going to get to wait on this guy.
Yeah, great.
And so it was great. So when I was a freshman in college, we were living together, roommates, and so like every Wednesday night, he would have another movie we'd get to go to, and so we would just see all these movies. And so then like when the Star Wars movies were re-released, we'd see it Wednesday, we'd see it opening night, and then I'd take my little brother on Sunday morning, right? And so it's just I just really fell in love with cinema there. And so I've always just really enjoyed this spectacle of seeing good movies. Where I kind of got the last few years, I've getting to know guys like JR and listening to Story Man occasionally and reading good reviews and finding some really great YouTubers who talk about movies. I've started to think about them in a different aspect. This is beyond just the entertainment side of things. And like, why do we tell these stories and what makes them so good? And so I've had more fun with that, and also I've even approached sort of reading that way, in the hopes I've always, I'm a computer nerd, but I've always wished I was a writer or creative, every time I've delved into that stuff, it has not usually, it's been a frustrating thing because I go into it thinking I want to write the greatest thing ever, and I have to temper my expectations because I'm not a good writer, right? I haven't spent time working on it. But I have a little blog, and for a while I was reviewing independent books, like people who self-published on Amazon. I would meet them online and get their books for them and write reviews for them. You know, it's sort of this like join that this little community of people who are doing this and trying to go after their dreams. And so I started doing that. And then early last year, when JR was doing all his top 10 lists and all my friends were doing all their top 10 lists of movies. And I'm like, crap, I could do a top 10 list for 2013, but I didn't get to really watch anything in 2015 because
you're like,
You're like me this year.
Yeah.
So like, what are your top movies? I said, well, here's my top eight because that's the eight I saw.
Right, right. So I decided that in 2016 that I was going to make a concerted effort to go to the movies and to watch movies and
see, to enjoy it. Yeah. You had to do that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But you know what? I think that there were some real gems in 2016. There were some things that really...
Yeah, they were all crammed into January 2017.
This is true. This is true. Hey, and I know that there's I noticed.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it started out great with Deadpool. I noticed there was some, I wouldn't call it hate, but some negativity towards Arrival. But for me, Arrival is one of the greatest movies I've seen in years. So
you mean by dumb people?
Yeah. People who are wrong.
Yeah,
exactly. Because I think that it's probably the best. I can't think of a better science fiction movie that I've seen in my adult life. For instance, like pure science fiction.
Well, I loved Arrival.
Well,
loved Arrival, but I mean, better science fiction. Man, I could.
Well, I mean,
he's saying that he's seen it in his adult life. I mean,
yeah. I'm not saying ever, but like. In a long time. I mean, I loved Ex Machina and there's a lot of good ones out there, but, mm-hmm. and I will say, you know, if we got into a discussion about it, there were some personal aspects to Arrival for me.
Sure. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
And we talked about the episode. Yeah. And so I can't let go of it. And I even watched it again 2 weeks ago and finally got my wife to see it. And she was equally moved by it because of some mm-hmm. stuff that we went through last year.
As an affecting of a sci-fi movie as Arrival for your adult life.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. But I also think I think it's genius for some of the stuff that it tries to bring up especially what I got out of it in terms of what it means to make choices and things like that. So I, for me, I think sci-fi is all about like what does it tell us about ourselves and what's it really about, right? Good science fiction isn't just about aliens on a screen. It's about it's about telling us who we are through aliens on a screen. Mm-hmm. So
I feel like that's something we talk about on the podcast. Like, so this is. We're heading into year 3 or 4 of the podcast now. I don't even know. So I think year 3. I don't know. Whatever. We're heading into 4.
Yeah.
We're rounding out 3.
Nice.
So 4 will start in summer.
So I feel like every year we have a conversation when the sci-fi movie of the year comes out, and we're like, man, why can't we get more sci-fi movies, or why can't we get more original sci-fi films? Or just whatever. I mean, because this is the conversation we had when we talked about the day after tomorrow.
The Edge of Tomorrow?
The Edge of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Live, Die, Repeat. Whatever it's right. being, whatever the studio is calling it this week. you know, we were like, yay, it's kind of, you know, a mostly original sci-fi premise. Why don't we get these very often? And then we basically don't get one for another year. And then I'm sure something came out in 2015. And then, you know, last year we got Arrival, and that was kind of like the sci-fi. Oh, we got Snowpiercer the year before.
Mm-hmm. True. And Ex Machina, wasn't that 2015?
So Snowpiercer, Ex Machina are both kind of one of those things where it's like, it's sci-fi, but it's not.
It's dystopian.
Yeah, it's either dystopian or kind of like a thriller. I mean, Ex Machina is a sci-fi. I wouldn't say it's not. But, you know, it's not like...
Yeah, I would say Snowpiercer is almost more dystopian, but yeah. I don't know. I guess it goes back to how do we define science fiction, right? And what are we saying it is?
But, so I feel like we just don't get a lot to choose from. And so I'm interested to see what will this year be. Well, this year, because this year has a couple options... that could be the sci-fi movie, or maybe we will actually finally get a year that will be more than one. It would be great.
What are the options?
What are the options coming up? Do you want to get right on the list?
Yeah, sure.
I'm mostly thinking about the Blade Runner.
Which another Vinny?
Yeah, it's like another Denis Villeneuve.
Yes.
Yeah. So I can't imagine it's like anyway. I'm with you. I think that's the point I wanted to make. I feel like, you know, obviously we're both, Mark and I are both on the Arrival train. So we're with you there. And I like what you were saying, and I'm glad you brought it back up, because I know we were talking about it a little bit before the show about how there was this idea that everything, no, I don't want to say everything is spiritual, but basically that's what we're saying. Like everything ties back to our faith. Like a good movie does, a good sports ball game does, you know, even wrestling. If it's telling a good story, it's connecting with us on some level, and everything is really spiritual.
What you're saying is story is powerful, entertainment is not mindless.
It is not, in my opinion, mindless. But that I think, and that's why I think it's interesting, or I'm very interested to see where this conversation goes, because the John Wick franchise,
mm-hmm.
basically now, right? John Wick franchise.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Is being pitched to me by people who either don't know that I review film or, you know, do this podcast. As like, oh man, it's just a great action movie. Just turn your brain off, go in, watch them shoot people in the face. And I'm like, okay, I'm down with that. You don't realize how I'm going to push back, or I just choose not to push back because of the company. But surely there's something else to this film besides a dude who just shoots people in the face. Well, because I don't deny that there is a dude who shoots people in the face. Right. A whole lot.
I love that chart you sent out, by the way. It's a great way to just visualize it. 128 kills.
Yeah.
All right, we're good.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely something I'm going to put in the show notes, because I did find a chart online that said not only how many people died in John Wick 2, but it showed how many people died by different methods.
Yes, it's great.
You mean like a pencil?
Yeah, for example.
Yes, yeah. Pencil's up there for two.
Yeah.
Two pencil, rope.
More than does John Wick have anything to say to us? I am actually curious. I know it might be seeming like it's coming out of left field, but I'm really curious. When everyone basically makes fun of Keanu Reeves for not being a great actor, and I think they're I think they're valid on this in a lot of things, because I don't really think he necessarily has a lot of range. I want to know from you guys, how does he continually end up in movie franchises that we really like? he just keeps ending up in these roles that like seem like he's perfect for.
I definitely took notes about that, because you're right. There's not a lot of range, but I don't think that says that he's not a great actor. I mean, yes, there are men, you know, and women who can totally change themselves into whatever they want, and that's cool and amazing. But there's also something to be said for like knowing what you do good and then just doing it great.
Yeah, I mean, Keanu's one of those just enigmatic kind of actors, because he is so good at some things and just for whatever reason just doesn't fit other things. You know, like when he was trying to do, what was the Hardball, the baseball movie that he did, was a pretty good movie, but kind of that didn't really fit. You know, when he's doing like Sweet November and the romantic stuff, he just doesn't really fit, but man, he can blow some heads apart. You know what I'm saying? Like, and there's a cool, he's really good at,
he can dodge bullets very well.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's, I've always thought, I saw Anthony Hopkins interviewed a long time ago, and he basically was, you know, defending these actors that basically are criticized for playing themselves every movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is Anthony Hopkins, and he was basically saying that takes a lot of talent and skill. I mean, it's hard to own something that long in multiple roles and in multiple settings. And I think Keanu just kind of does that. Keanu is his own persona, and he tries to alter that a little bit here and there for certain things, and it might work and it might not, but it definitely works in kind of the everyman action hero role. Yeah. I mean, he's born for that.
The epiphany I had, and it's so strange that I never realized this, but he is like the action star. Like growing up, you'd always like throw out names like of the your Schwarzeneggers, your Stallones, mm-hmm. Van Damme, or any of these guys that were making these sort of. But I mean, he's the star. Like, from Speed to Point Break to The Matrix to John Wick. I mean, he not only makes great movies, but he makes great movies that people start copying. He's in movies that people start copying their style afterwards on top of it. Mm-hmm. And I was blown away by that. I had never really put that thought together before.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing about thinking about the action star, because I always think about, like, who would you cast if you made, like, a whatever action movie? And I almost never think about Keanu Reeves, because I think I usually go to Tom Cruise. I would say Tom Cruise, but
10 years ago, maybe Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, maybe 15 years, yeah. We're older.
Well, the thing, with Willis, he's got to want to be there, because so you're just going to pay him, he's going to phone it in. But
that's the thing, though. But there's something that you just said.
Well, dang it, Bruce there.
I love Bruce, but he's been in some really bad movies.
Well, intentionally so.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, he makes them that way. So, anyways.
I think the thing that you said that I think hits the nail on the head for me that differentiates them is the fact that while, you know, Tom Cruise is making the Mission Impossible, he's going to be in the Mummy remake for some reason.
Yeah.
Like, and generally he's just making movies that are more or less Mission Impossible that are not called Mission Impossible when he's not doing it. Jack Reacher.
Except for Edge of Tomorrow.
Except for Edge of Tomorrow. Hmm. Or Live, Die, Repeat. Like,
cut it out. Just call it what it is.
Call it what it was.
It's Edge of Tomorrow.
So he is doing a lot of movies and he seems to be copying himself a lot. But I love what you said, because Keanu Reeves tends to be in these movies that are not just action movies, and they're not great action movies, but they seem to be iconic, or they seem to be like changing the name of the game. Like, sure, Tom Cruise has been in 5 Mission Impossibles. But Mission Impossible are kind of like, you know, cutting the same cookies over and over and over again. Like, Keanu Reeves he's gone from Bill and Ted to, which is a cult iconic, like, staple of at least my youth, to Speed. And the Speed, just the concept of the Speed movies, like, it's incredible how popular Speed is.
Yep.
For a movie that's not that complicated.
Nope.
And then a movie that's incredibly complicated, The Matrix, which, I mean, basically everyone has copied something from The Matrix. And whether it's him that's doing this, or the fact that he just kind of keeps landing in these roles that are great. I mean, because now, I can't imagine anyone's not going to copy John Wick, because even though John Wick seems on the surface to be just pure action bliss, you know, and like I said, when people were saying mindless, we have a problem with that. Right. Not out of necessity.
I guess maybe they mean mindless as in he blows so many brains out.
Like, there's no mind.
There's no mind.
There are very few. There are fewer minds at the end of the movie than there were at the beginning.
Well, I just think there is something else going on there, especially with like the world building. When I think about action franchises, I think about the Mission Impossible. I think James Bond, sort of. I think Jason Bourne, and I feel like John Wick is just right now a cut above.
Oh, for sure.
And I want one of you guys to tell me that I'm just out of line.
No.
Yeah, I think the issue with some of those franchises is. And maybe John Wick is just because there's only two of them, right? But some of those franchises, you can name one of theirs that is like, eh, right? And so it sort of taints the whole franchise.
It's so hard to watch or to make a movie that is so dependent on action and not get bored watching it. I remember Laura and I sat down to watch the latest Jason Bourne movie, and we were literally bored, almost out of our minds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we didn't care about anything that was going on. We didn't care about Jason Bourne. We didn't, like, an action sequence would start and we would just tune out, like, check our phone or something. It was just, don't care. But, like, in a John Wick film, I feel like I can't look away. And I have
missed three headshots. If you...
But that's the thing. I mean, he's already shot like 100 other people in the head. Why am I caring about these three shots? Yeah. What is different, Mark? Why is this? Why would you? Like, well, let me rephrase it this way. I know that you love the James Bond franchise. Mm-hmm. Why would you go see a John Wick movie before you'd see a Bond movie?
Well, to Jason's points, where they are right now, you know, Spectre was disappointing because it kind of did what the latest Jason Bourne did, which is just kind of things got kind of glossy and lazy. And but man, I had the same feeling as when I watched the first John Wick and really the second John Wick, even though I knew what I was getting into, that I got from Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. I mean, that's my favorite Bond movie, and that's the Bond that I always want to mm-hmm. see now when I go to. But, you know, Bond movies didn't used to look like that. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the Jason Bourne style James Bond. You know, and I think why now John Wick is so interesting, he doesn't want to look away, is because they're doing something new, which is sort of old, you know, because there's nothing new under the sun, really. And Hollywood is sort of cyclical in that, you know, I feel like around the mid-2000s, action movies started getting away from that Matrix style, which everything was sleek and computer-generated and these new kind of, like, flashy techniques, and getting back to, we actually blew up a real car, you know, or we actually jumped off that building. And so the action started going back to the old sort of style or the old techniques, because back then that was the only technique that they had, was to actually throw somebody off a building.
I want to use the word gritty here for some reason.
You want to use the word gritty?
Gritty.
Well, John Wick's not gritty. It really is not.
Slick.
It's very slick. And it's very sleek, and because those are two different things, let me tell you. It's not gritty. It's grisly in the fact that you see a lot of, you know, brain matter and stuff. I'm getting graphic here. But I think that there's a... It's the style, and it's the attention to detail, and it's the choreography, and it's not phoning in with computer-generated effects. I mean, this is something that we're trying to get sort of back to and reinvent and throw out new style to it and new ideas behind it and get really fun and creative with it. So that's why John Wick's working right now. Mm-hmm. And if we get four more John Wick movies, we might get kind of tired of it, and it might move on to something else. So, Jason,
yeah, you're gonna say something? Well, I think what's interesting to me is getting some of these stories behind the story, like what's going on and how it was made. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you look at a movie, like even the latest Mission Impossible or John Wick 2, this article from IndieWire that I read that talks about how Stahelski and Keanu even got to know each other, and then to learn how this director has been – you know, where his start was and how he turned that passion into the ability to make movies as a director is amazing. And so you can, I mean, the love of the people working on the film is almost palpable when you watch it because of that. You can tell how much they cared about the details. They cared about working. I mean, you get the YouTube video of how Keanu prepared for the first John Wick mm-hmm. with all of the firearms training he went through so that it looked like a man shooting a gun and we could believe it, right? And then on the flip side, you know, I think when we had an article about getting the right cinematographer for a movie like this, right? And getting someone who understands how you want to light this and how you want to shoot it, and getting away from stuff like shaky cam and multiple quick takes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys watch Honest Trailers, but the Honest Trailer for John Wick, I mean, it totally decimated Taken.
Yeah.
And the way that they have to make – the way you – what it takes to make Liam Neeson look like an action star, just, you know, versus – Keanu literally rolling downstairs with Common in one take, and we're going to film the whole thing and we're going to do it right in one take. Like there's two very different ways of making film. And I think you feel that when you watch the movie is that. And so I think what would make John Wick bad as a franchise in the future is when they get tired and they're just cashing a check and they're going to get lazy. Cause that's what I felt like Bourne was. It's like, well, we haven't made one in a few years, and so let's just mm-hmm. basically put the last three back together and make a new one. And so that was kind of boring because there was nothing new. I mean, they destroyed how many cars in Vegas, and they had all these big fight scenes, and yet your description, Mikey, that it was kind of boring is I think true.
So I think somewhere in there's a tangential conversation about why Matt Damon has made so many bad movies lately. but outside of that, yeah, I feel like all that you guys have brought up is great. Something that you guys haven't mentioned that I would love to get your opinion on is the importance of world building. I feel like in most action movies, so again, if we go back to a Bond, or at least a recent Bond, Mission Impossible, these things that are held up as the action franchises, there's a point in the film where someone comes along and is like, this is my plan. And it's like overly complicated. It's very convoluted. And then they explain the whole thing to us, which makes it actually seem to like make more sense. What is John Wick doing different that's making it succeed?
It's interesting because, you know, like going back to the Bourne movie, the last Bourne, I think I mentioned you on Facebook, like the bad guys are so cartoonish, and yet you're trying to make it seem realistic. It also made it very difficult to watch the Bourne movie. I think John Wick just trusts you. It's like, look, you know what the world is, or it doesn't really matter why. We're going to have fun with the what. And what the situation is, and we're going to trust you as an audience to keep up. I enjoyed that about it.
Well, the villain in the first John Wick wasn't really a traditional villain. I mean, he wasn't even really an antagonist, other than like John Wick's protagonist spurred him on to be that. He was just kind of like minding his own business, being a mobster, and his son goes out and makes this guy angry, and you know,
the boogeyman.
But I thought in John Wick 2, I think as a, it's hard for me to say, I've been going back and forth in my mind about this, but I think John Wick 2 is a better movie, even though I'm not certain of that. Because John Wick, the original, is just so very good. It's just very simple. It's very focused. It's very, and it's focused on minute details. Mm-hmm. Which is what makes it so good. But the world building here and just kind of really what they explore with John Wick, I think, is what makes – edges John Wick 2 out. Anyway, but I think the weakest part of this movie is the villain. I mean, I think this villain does have a little bit of a mustache twirl kind of, you know, from his style and his actions and his you know, kind of half-hatched plan and all that, I thought was – The setup around him and the world built around him props him up to be a good villain, but the villain itself I just thought was pretty weak. I don't know.
Can we say that that's the point then? That like,
yeah,
the villain isn't the point,
right? Exactly.
Like John Wick's the point.
John Wick's the point, and I think that that's because John Wick, the character, the protagonist, is so good, and so well done, and so perfectly focused on. That it doesn't matter, you know. We talk about villains a lot lately because all the villains that come out are basically Marvel villains, and we talk about Marvel villains all the time, and you know how Marvel villains are bad. And it's like the example I always end up using is Thor 2. I like Malekith as a villain. If you've not seen the movie and you're listening to this, don't worry about it. I mean, it's not gonna ruin the point, and I'm not gonna spoil anything. But Malekith is an interesting villain to me that isn't done very well because Thor isn't done very well, really. Thor doesn't have, you know, the same protagonist-antagonist relationship as he did with Loki in the first one. He doesn't have that reason to care about Malekith. And I feel like the villain in John Wick 2 is the same level of villain. Interesting, kind of flashy, sort of has a plan, that's it. But he works better because everything around him is built to prop him up, to give something for John Wick to knock down, right? Malekith was just there.
Literally just there.
Just there. And because you sort of have to have that for your structure and everything. I still like Thor 2 a lot, Anyway, I just enjoy it. I'm not saying it's a good movie or anything. But I think that's what John, to answer your question, is what John Wick is doing pretty well, is that they are setting up things for John Wick to knock down, you know, and I think that's the point, and that's why the character is what's driving these things, you know.
So go ahead, Jason.
You know, what's interesting is I was thinking about world building, especially on this, and comparing it. I actually have been spending more time in my head comparing it to things that aren't action franchises. I think the Marvel comparison is an interesting one, that this comes across almost like a superhero movie from that perspective, right? It's really not about the bad guy. And that's, I think that's the one way I can look at Marvel movies. It's called Captain America or Iron Man for a reason. And so we're following them. And it's kind of the same thing here, as we're following him. You wish that there was a little bit better bad guy at times, right? Because I want to understand the motivation. But I saw the comparison there. The other one on the world building side was, and I can't get away from this in my head, is Harry Potter. Because I was baffled when I watched these movies that you've got these assassins running around the real world like wizards, because nobody notices what's going on until the magic starts flying, right? Until they totally mess something up. Like, people are just going around. I mean, you've got that whole scene with Common and they're shooting at each other and no one has batted an eye, you know, just because I got silencers on, right? Yeah. And I think that's really an interesting way of building this secret world around him that makes it so compelling.
Oh, it's such a great scene too. Such a great scene.
Yeah, it's very good.
Well, and it's interesting that kind of wizard world, you know, muggle world comparison, where what's his face at the end, he's talking to John Wick and telling him everything and showing him how much control he has, and all the people in the park stop.
Oh, you're talking about Winston
and free Winston.
Yeah.
And they just freeze. And it just shows you the depth of how far this really goes. And we haven't even scratched the surface, it seems, at that point.
Yeah, I really love that. It basically, it's one of the few movies I've seen come out in the past couple of years that actually trusts its audience to be smart enough to either figure it out or know that they will eventually figure it out.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a world of show not tell, they're just kind of showing us.
Yeah. And it's really hard, man, to create a story that just shows just enough for you to get it and then not get in the way of what's going on in the events of the story.
Yeah, I feel like if you pitch a movie where you don't, like, somebody reads the script and they don't understand it right away, then they're probably like, you need someone to come in and explain this in the story, and then you lose the mystery.
Which is what a lot of the Mission Impossible films do. I mean, they spend a lot of time explaining these complicated behind-the-scenes spy. It's a spy genre, so there's a lot. You tend to kind of need to have more complex scenarios to get the believability, I guess, of there being this, you know, hidden working kind of Cold War scenario going on. But
they always do seem to bring someone into the team who doesn't know how things work, so they get to explain it to everybody.
Yes.
No. Right.
It's a trope. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, and I would say, to be fair, I think if you don't watch John Wick, you do miss out on something watching John Wick 2. Like, they don't.
Yeah.
Like, almost all sequels are made today where you can pick up, even if you haven't seen the previous ones. Even Marvel films are made in such a way where someone comes along and typically reminds you a great deal of what has come before, even if it's not like super thorough, or if it's not super perfect, they remind you enough to get caught up, to know who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, and what general direction the story is going. Whereas in John Wick, I'm not saying you can't have fun watching John Wick 2.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you can't have fun watching John Wick 2, you either have some very, very very strict ideas about what you can or can't watch in a film, or you just have very philosophical issues with, like, murder, which, I mean, actually,
or you're lying.
Yeah, yeah. Or you just don't like to have fun. Or you're Amish and you just never went to the theater in the first place. Someone was describing it to you. It's like, then he shoot, you're reading the script, you know? It's like, he shoots him in the head. 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 He rolls. He shoots him in the head. Yeah. Like, this is the shortest script.
Well, occasionally he shoots him in the foot to shoot him in the head.
Yeah. I mean,
come on.
Shoots him in the foot.
Or he uses another instrument going through the head. Yeah. Not just the bullet.
So, I feel like a criticism of John Wick, chapter two, is that you do miss something about John Wick. You do miss something about the world.
Yeah, as soon as he walks into the Continental and sees the receptionist at the desk and they instantly have that connection.
Yeah.
You don't understand that connection as fully as if you saw the first movie and you understand their relationship.
I mean, because he still recognizes him in the first movie, but you don't have some of that.
Yeah.
You know, anyway. So, I'm amazed that this film even exists. Because I don't know how someone basically greenlit it with a script that I would say would be criticized as incomplete, which, you know, I think we would all agree is wrong.
Do you think?
I think so. I think lots of times if you take a John Wick script like this and you don't have everything explained, I think that a producer would be like, I don't think people are going to get this, and I think they would not trust the audience. And somehow this got through. They trusted the audience.
But I would say the answer to that is more you're talking about like John Wick 1, where it didn't, the outerlying world didn't matter at all. Like, it really didn't matter at all. It matters a great deal to this story.
Mm-hmm.
But in the first one, it doesn't matter at all. And you just get the seeds of it. And you're like, oh, that's an interesting thought if that's, you know, part of this world. And he's just going to go get revenge. It's just a revenge tale. You know, so, oh, okay. So
I like to think it's a love story.
Yeah. Well, okay. Love story with his dog and sure. I think so if you're seeing the script for John Wick 2, you're going to have a lot more trust after knowing how successful and how well done John Wick 1 was. That makes sense.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm talking about John Wick just as a franchise.
Right, sure.
So whichever one gets greenlit, not necessarily two. Yeah. Obviously, if you make one that makes money and people love it, surprisingly, you're going to make another.
And this one's already well past its budget, so we're definitely getting a third one.
Yay!
John Wick versus the world.
That's right.
Can't wait.
And I'm
basically
already going to go see it opening weekend. Yep. Doesn't matter. So,
oh yeah.
So something you mentioned earlier when you were talking about villains, Mark, is our villain, at least in chapter two, is basically just running around setting up things for John Wick to knock down.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said that John Wick is a great character.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, what is it about John Wick that we're connecting with as an audience? Are we just living our video game fantasies through John Wick?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there more substance to his pain and struggle and life?
Well, I like what you pointed out, Jason, the comparison to the superhero genre. Because John Wick is basically a superhero. I mean, really.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes. I mean, he gets shot at a lot. A lot. And the dude doesn't get shot. So, and
well, he got shot a number of times.
He does, but like, you know.
He's got a fancy suit.
He's got a fancy suit. He's got a suit of iron. Like, you could say he's like an Iron Man.
What?
I need to write that down. Maybe I can make a comic book out of that or something. Iron Man. By Mark.
We'll call him Iron Suit.
Yes, Iron Suit. Oh boy. So yes, I think he is a superhero. And the reason why I say that, being important to my point, I don't know. The movie's called John Wick. It's about him, and he's just, for in comparison to us and most of the normal general audience, unless there are some MI6 people watching these movies. Mm-hmm. He's way more super in what he does than we are. But what grounds him, despite that, is he deals with very real, very human things. And I think it's focused on just enough to where that it's not heavy-handed, it's not campy, it's not overdone. I really think this is the strength of Keanu Reeves in this role. And why I think John Wick works is because Keanu Reeves is so good at being John Wick, is the very subtle but very obvious pain that he's in. And it's the High Noon character. Like, so if you've ever seen High Noon, Gary Cooper, wonderful, wonderful portrayal in that role, to where that he had just kind of has this constant grimace on his face the entire time because he's burdened by what he has to do, the role that he is forced into. I mean, that sounds like John Wick, does it not? he's very burdened by this past that, you know, he's still got to answer the call for, or he's very burdened by his, you know, and I love that in the first John Wick, he is just seething with anger. I mean, it's all anger. It's all rage. And he's going to go kill everybody.
Why is it that, like, he delivers, like, lines, and sometimes I feel like the worst way, yet it still works.
Yeah.
Just
because
people keep asking, am I back?
Yeah. I'm thinking I'm back.
I'm like, this, oh, it's such a terrible delivery.
But it works.
But it works.
Because it's raw, and he's, you know, I think it's real. Anyway, I love how, like, non-linear and non, you know, policy speaking. But in the first John Wick, he's just all rage. Oh, I'm thinking I'm back. You're going to die screaming beside him. You know, that whole thing. And I love in this one how he's just slower, and you could just tell the pain has weighed on him. And I really feel like the first one is about anger, and the second one is about pain, and how the pain just doesn't ever leave, and you are forced to act, not necessarily upon it, but despite of it. You have to act no matter what happens. And he is, you know, that's why he understands this whole world and this whole mark on this emblem or token or whatever, that he's blood bound to this role. And this guy presents it to him, and he still says, no, I'm not your guy, I can't do this. Despite what he knows, what the consequences are, he knows that he's not just going to be able to kick back and watch, you know, football for the rest of his, you know, just in his nice cushy home. Mm-hmm. He's going to have to answer for this. And so I just love that I felt like Keanu Reeves had an evolution with this character. And this is why this character works so much for me, is that he's just so melancholy in everything that he's doing. I mean, he's killing all these guys and he's fighting as hard as he can. And you still see the pain on his face. And then they have these moments where he's sitting in this burnt house and the rain's pouring down. And it's not, you know, overly sappy or remote. It's just quiet. And it's just, he's just sitting in his pain. And I really feel like what makes this movie work so well is they really take the time to focus on his, you know, sorrow. Mm-hmm. And it really is what drives the character to kind of push forward, and he really has this evolution out of this pain of, like, I think I can do this even though I don't want to. I know I have to, so let's get it over with. You know, I think that's him running at the end. You know, it's kind of like an Empire Strikes Back where it's not an ending, but you know it is an ending, and it feels like a stop because I feel like that's his evolution. All right, I'm out. I'm going to do this. You know, it's like when we move on from our pain, and I think that's something that resonates within us. It's, he's still got this immense pain, this immense sorrow, this thing that was taken from him, and he's got to live with that. I love how they pay attention to, it's not just like, oh, his wife died, now he's mad. And that's it, and that's all you get. It haunts him, and that's real.
Yeah.
Pain haunts us. And I love that they examine what pain makes us do, you know, and how we react to, I mean, these are very human things that we're talking about in basically a superhero, violent, bloodthirsty movie. You know?
Yeah. Well, I like what you're saying about pain too, because one of the things that, in a very metaphorical way, because I'm hoping this isn't an actual choice people are making, the idea of people kind of running from what they were created to be. Mm-hmm. And while I'm hoping that no one is really, God's not churning out people who are supposed to be like John Wick killers.
Yeah, yeah.
But this idea that, like, he is something, like, he's not just like an assassin. He, like, is the assassin, you know. He's the boogeyman, you know? Like, he is the guy.
Yeah.
You know, he, for, you know, all the complaints that I can have, either philosophically or theologically, with his propensity to murder people on a whim, like, he obviously has been gifted at something, and he's running from this for reasons that seem maybe altruistic or maybe honorable. But when those are stripped away, he still wants to hold on to this thing that he is not. Mm-hmm. And there's this verse in Luke chapter 12. And in the Message, I think it captures the essence of it real well, where it says you can't keep your true self hidden forever. Before long, you'll be exposed. It goes on to talk about you can't hide behind a religious mask forever. Sooner or later, the mask will slip and your true face will be known. And I know it's speaking specifically about holding yourself up to, like, by religion, but it's still almost like this religion that he has. He has this belief that he can get out of who he is. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm hoping that, like, it is only metaphorical, because I wouldn't want to, we don't want to encourage people
to be assassins.
But it is interesting to watch this internal struggle. I'm seeing the pain mm-hmm. that you're talking about stripping away, like, his layers of almost false reality, you know, like, I've got another dog, still got my house, mm-hmm. just getting my car fixed. Yeah. Like, I'm going to keep burying this stuff. You know, it's like when we, I feel like I'm really not trying to Jesus juke this podcast, but it really is.
I'm hearing that term everywhere now. Yeah. Jesus juke.
It's JR's fault.
Oh my gosh.
Is that a JR?
but like, he really is, like, he realizes that he doesn't want to do this thing, and so he buries his old life, mm-hmm. right? He covers
literally.
He buries it in the ground and covers it with cement. But that, to me, is symbolic of when we think we're gonna stop, like, sinning, doing something, mm-hmm. and we're like, oh well, I'm just not gonna. I mean, like, say you struggle with consumption. Say you drink too much, mm-hmm. you know, and you have a propensity to get drunk. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, I really sin when I do that. So what I'm gonna do is I'm only gonna do that when we're having a party. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not gonna drink at home. I'm just gonna kind of bury it over here, and I probably will never get it out again mm-hmm. because there's cement covering it. Mm-hmm. But he's always giving himself a place to go back to. Like, he knows at the end of the day, he can get the sledgehammer out. If things get bad enough, mm-hmm. he can take the sledgehammer, he can bust through the concrete, he can open the box. If he really wanted to leave that life, if he really wanted to leave it behind, mm-hmm. he would get rid of all the gold coins, he would get rid of all the guns, mm-hmm. And there would be no way that he would have access to them.
Yeah, in a way, he's Jonah getting swallowed by the whale. I mean, he's running from what he's sort of called to. I know it's an imperfect thing, but I just see that the whale swallowing him as his life, you know.
I just think you stumbled upon a great script. Like, Jonah the assassin. Jonah Wick.
He's good.
His ancestor.
Wow.
Jonah Wick, chapter 3 of the whale.
Listeners, I apologize for bringing this out.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited about Jonah Wick. It's going to be like the Christian version of John Wick.
There you go.
You know?
There'll be a VeggieTales of it.
Can Shawn Michaels play Jonah?
No, Kevin Sorbo will, because that's what Kevin Sorbo does. It'll be awesome.
I guess it should be the guy from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., right? I mean, he's the new, anyway.
Oh, yeah, because he was in that one movie with Shawn Michaels and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Gosh, God, that guy is such a terrible actor. He is perfect for Christian movies.
Wow.
I'm just saying.
We're there now.
Hey, so Jason, do you have any thoughts on any of these things that we've been talking about for the past 10 minutes?
Tell me about John Wick, the character, Jason.
You know, I think that there were when you posed the question before the before we got on the phone,
before the tangent.
Yeah, no, this idea of quiet life versus calling was one mm-hmm. of the sort of prompts you'd given us ahead of time. I kind of gave that, was giving thought to that. And again, it's strange because we're talking about an assassin, a man bred completely for murder. But at the same time, when you were making your explanation just now, you were also kind of going back and forth between this burying what I'm called for versus burying what I know is wrong.
Oh yeah, there are two separate thoughts that I totally got crossed up, and I apologize.
Yeah, and so I think both are interesting. I think one is, you know, we always think that there's this peaceful, quiet life out there, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where life happens. You know, I'm gonna put my feet up on a beach with a Mai Tai and just relax, right? And just enjoy life, because that's living. I know that there are probably people who have found that life, but I don't know them. and the reality, I think what happens is this quiet life we're constantly trying to go after, it's never that way. Pain continues to come back to us over and over and over again, because the world is still broken. And what we really find is when we embrace the calling, that we find where life really is. And again, so I've been struggling for how we would do that with John here, because I don't think he's found life yet. I think that idea that what Mark had of by the end of the movie, though, he's finally embracing that I'm not that anymore, and I'm running, and I'm going to be okay with that. I'm going to embrace what it is about who I am. Like, I'm sure he's going to be more than willing to kill the people coming after him, but I'm not going to be a part of that life anymore. I'm going to take who I am and go and do and seek whatever it is that I can, you know, take that passion, that talent that I have, and use it for something different. So I think there's a couple.
You're saying he's not going to conform to the world.
Right. Yes. Well, yes, he's natural, not. That's exactly it.
So the thematic progression of that, like I said, in the first one is he can't control it. He's angry. He's going to go kill lots of people because he feels like he needs to do that because his anger is just overtaking him. And he cannot control it. Versus the second one, I think it's pretty clear that it is controlling him. He's kind of surrendered to this job he has to do, and he's just going through the motions. And now I think him running away and literally just stepping up and defying literally what looks like the entire world of people, I think that the next progression is him controlling it and trying to maneuver through it to end it. So it really does feel like a sort of a setup for a good solid trilogy, even though
it's basically probably Matrix.
I mean, it sort of is, but
you're saying like he's made aware of the world that he has to be a part of. Then in the second, he becomes higher than that world, and the third one is he tries to change that world.
Yes, essentially.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I thought you were gonna get some snarky out of that one.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the Matrix did that quite well, actually, for all the messiness in the final film. But that setup works, and Keanu was great in it. So, how ironic!
No, what he was,
and Lawrence Fishburne was in it too. So,
hey, just like this film.
Hey.
Yeah. You might think that Hollywood is cool, cyclical.
So there's this other aspect that I think is debatable, and that is the idea of justice. I think, especially since we've kind of stumbled upon this comparison to superhero films. I like how we're referring to superhero films as Marvel films. You know, we're just assuming that.
Well, like there aren't any others.
That's right. I mean,
well,
there might
DC
be
DC makes a superhero film. I'll
yeah, I mean, there are other comic book films or things based on comic books.
I mean, you know, superhero films. I know DC's making Academy Award winning films. But they certainly aren't making any superhero films.
The only comic book movie that in these Marvel and DC that's won an Academy Award is literally the worst movie.
Yeah.
And I mean that extremely
this is getting ready to become literally the Oscar post show.
Well, I mean, of all the things the Academy could do, right? Like, how did they let that happen?
Well, an achievement in film is an achievement in film, even in a bad film. So, but is that, like I said, I didn't tangent. So we've stumbled upon this. We stumbled upon this superhero comparison to John Wick, and in almost every superhero film, one of the key things that we basically don't even talk about anymore when we talk about superhero films is this idea of striving for justice. You know, Captain America. He's just justicing on everybody, you know, like Iron Man is kind of like trying to do justice in his weird, jacked up, alcohol, like weird, self-indulgent way.
Playboy way.
Yeah, his Playboy way. And like, you know, so everyone, all these heroes, Guardians of the Galaxy, are trying to act justly, even though they're a band of misfits. Like there's this theme of justice that runs through all superhero movies. And since this is, admittingly, a superhero movie, we see John Wick trying to achieve justice, but it looks awful odd. But I don't think that means that people aren't resonating with it. Like, you are actually, or maybe let me put this in a form of a question. At any point, are you not rooting for John Wick?
No.
Why not? He, like I said, he's murdering people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
But they killed his dog.
Yeah.
I mean, they killed his dog. Come on.
Well, there's lots of answers to that.
Well, so you kill a dog, one dog's life, one innocent dog's life is worth 128 people. Let's just stick to this movie. So I'm taking your number from the beginning, Jason, because I didn't look at the article very recently.
At the kill stats.
I didn't look at the kill stats lately.
I've got it up. It's 128 according to the wonderful article.
So I was not up before the podcast checking on the KDR of John Wick. So
death ratio for those playing along at home.
But it's good. Yeah. Let's just say.
Yeah, it's above
ratio,
average.
Is it ratio or rate?
Ratio.
Ratio, yes.
Because it's like a whatever to whatever. It's a ratio.
Gotcha.
21.
Gotcha.
Whatever. This one's 128 to 0. It's an incredible ratio. he needs to go to like video game tournaments so he would win all of them.
That's right.
He'd be really good at Counter-Strike.
He'd be like the Bo Jackson of Counter-Strike. Bo Jackson from Tecmo Bowl. Like, you just can't tackle him. You can't kill John Wick.
What if there was there's a mod for like Counter Strike, where you can be John Wick and like you just don't ever get shot,
you just don't ever die.
Like everything's a headshot.
That definitely needs to be like some sort of cheat code on some future first-person shooter.
For sure.
Just type in John Wick and you get auto headshot.
If the title of this episode is not John Wick and the Bo Jackson of Counter Strikes, I'm gonna be real mad.
That's a little long.
John Wick and everything's a headshot
and all headshots.
Cheat code.
And all your headshotter belong to us.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So we are somehow on board with the fact that John Wick has his house blown up.
Yeah.
And one blown up house is worth 128 human lives.
Right. Well, okay. There's just a lot to that. Like, you know, we especially currently right now, we live in the age of the anti-hero. I feel like I talk about this all the time, but like the anti-heroes are our heroes right now, for better or for worse. You know, the Walter Whites and the Dexters of the world, right? We, you know, you're rooting for Dexter, you're rooting for Walter White, but I mean, they're not even like going for justice. They're just going for satiating the need for what they need. Mm-hmm. And we're rooting for these people. We put the Joker on our t-shirts and wear them to the mall, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Nobody goes to the mall
anymore.
Nobody goes
to the mall.
Well, sorry. We wear Joker to church. How about that?
I do wear my Batman shirt to church.
Well, but that's Batman.
He's kind of an anti-hero. He's
the
Dark Knight.
Yeah.
The Dark Knight.
Anyway. And part of that is, you know, another answer, all this stuff's popping in my head, but part of it's in movie making, you have the save the cat moment at the beginning. You give the audience something to be empathetic to, and that's your dog, you know, literally a dog dying, literally, you know, saving the cat at the beginning out of the tree. That's, you know, you give a hero a version of that to provide them empathy for the rest of the movie or the rest of the franchise. So we're just following this because we have been set up to give a reason to it. If we were to get into and focus on the lower aspects of what John Wick used to do, and maybe he accidentally or purposefully killed an innocent or something like that, then we'd have a different bend to this character. We don't know that yet, so it's partly setting that up, but also partly this story is set up for justice to be. You're laughing.
Sorry, I was just thinking about John Wick before.
Yeah,
like the things we don't know, because he could have like been hired to like murder a woman or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm thinking like, but if he was really a professional, mm-hmm. he'd be like, no women, no kids.
Yeah.
That's the professional's rule.
That is the professional's rule. How about that? Dialing it back. 95, it's Leon. It's
a good movie.
It's a great movie. Mm-hmm. If you're listening and you have not seen Leon the Professional, like we God, all so heartily endorse it, apparently.
Natalie Portman's amazing in that.
Yeah, and she's like 12. Yes.
This is for Matilda.
Oh, gosh. Don't. I'm going to cry. Great movie.
Gary Oldman, yes, crushing it.
Oh, Gary.
Sorry, you were. This is a total tangent. I just like talking about movies where people die a lot.
Our sense of justice in this world that we're watching is John Wick killing all the guys that are trying to kill him. I mean, it's just kind of the impetus, mm-hmm. impetus of the story structure. You know, you want him to. So, you know, you want that justice, and I think it also is, going back to the character, you resonate with his pain, you resonate with his fleeing a calling, whatever you want to, whatever sticks to you. John Wick is a real character fighting to do what is set up in this world and in this movie universe to be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think I can resonate with that because I think that in the real world, in the world that we actually inhabit, like, I have a lot of qualms with violence being used because I think violence begets violence. But when you tell a story, and that's one thing, going back to world building, in John Wick, they build a world that, like, assumes murder, death gratuitously.
Yes.
And so when you set up the rules of this world that says, like, this is how things are accomplished, for some reason, I'm able to flip a switch and say, yeah, I get this. Like, I don't feel like this is, like, saying that, like, we need to kill people to resolve our issues.
Right.
It feels like an obstacle, mm-hmm. you know? And in this world, obstacles look like shooting people in the head. Or shooting him, again, thank you, Jason, in the foot, and then in the head.
exactly.
Well, there's a question that I keep having is, where does all this fodder come from? Like... How are these hundreds and hundreds of people able to know about this world and give, you know, basically give their lives for it? Is what was kind of fascinating as well. Like you start to get the sense that they're not real people. Going back to the, you know, even the Harry Potter analogy of muggles and wizards, right? It's just like it almost doesn't, like, it's so fantastical what's going on. And I don't know if maybe that's the trick of the movie, but you have to really go back to, no, these are supposed to be real people that he's, you know, murdering the whole time. Mm-hmm. But there are these, you know, it's dozens, it's hundreds. It's at the end scene, an entire park full of people that are a part of this world. And I feel like they kind of know what they're a part of as well. Like they've accepted that's the world they're a part of.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, I think that hits on something that is fundamentally, it's a fundamental issue with violence for me in the actual real world. Jason, you talk about how, like these bad guys, I mean, where do they go? Do they go to henchmen.com?
Right. You know? Well, like, they're literal red shirts. Like? I mean, yeah. there's a whole scene of literal red shirts in this film as well. Yeah. So.
I mean, so one of the reasons I think we don't stop for John Wick's violence is, I think, echoed through reality, and that's like we don't see these people as people. We just see them as faceless, anonymous henchmen that are almost like they could be cardboard cutouts mm-hmm. for as much emotional investment that we have in them. And I would say that if you take that and you apply it to the real world, that's usually the way that we justify violence for almost anyone. When we're like, hey, I can't wait till the military goes and bombs those people. It's because those people are, like, they're nameless to us. Mm-hmm. Or when, you know, when people have a problem with, like, a mob or a protest of people and they say, oh, all of those people just need to be, you know, shot or whatever. Like, it's, like, you've dehumanized them. And that's about the only way that we can actually justify violence. By basically dehumanizing our enemy or someone or just another human being that would otherwise not be our enemy. It's why some of the, you know, the best scenes in films are when you run up against two people that know each other very well and you know somebody has to come out on top. Mm-hmm. It's why deaths in Game of Thrones are very hard. Mm-hmm. You know, when you spend three or four seasons with somebody, that's tough. Mm-hmm. It's why, going back to Harry Potter, the Battle of Hogwarts, you know, was hard for some people because there are some characters that have been there for, you know, six movies that don't make it out. Now, not really anybody important, not like Game of Thrones, but you know, but still people you're invested in, people who actually have, they're more than, like I said, a one-dimensional or two-dimensional technically cardboard cutout. Mm-hmm. So, right.
Well, so I guess for me is part of the question is, you know, we want to look at this in a positive light. Like, but there is an aspect of fantasy in watching a movie like this. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we all have had probably moments where we have thoughts like you were just describing, Mikey, or I've heard people say, and it's sometimes it's groups of people, but it's also the pretend guy who's going to hurt me in the future and what I'm going to do if that ever happens to me. Mm-hmm. Right. Like there's an aspect to this of we wish we had the strength to be John Wick when people hurt us sometimes. We have to recognize there's an unhealthiness sometimes to it as well.
Because we desire
in being drawn to a movie like this.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the things that I noticed when I was watching the movie is, like, it was the night before Valentine's Day, and it was packed with dates, and there was a lot of laughter during the movie.
Yeah,
for that, you know, during really cringeworthy death scenes. It goes back to this. There is this. We also watch it because sometimes watching violence, you know, we get a thrill out of it. It's fun.
Yeah, I mean, we could totally have a whole podcast talk about the nature of violence in film and video games and how it affects us. I mean, that's an ongoing debate. Yeah. You know, and I think we have to, you know, you have to, when you're into that debate, you have to consider that it's just a tool of filmmaking, just like sci-fi is. You know, if you're you know, CGI constructing a spaceship and they're flying through space, it's the same thing as, you know, choreographing headshots. You know, it's another tool. It's a more visceral tool and one that is more based in reality and one that is more, if you think about it and apply it to the real world, is kind of horrifying, but it is a way to tell a story. And the essence of this story is a man that is running from a life that he wants to leave, that's still trying to sink its claws into him. And he's got to deal with grief and pain that is just overwhelming him. And he's not sure what to do about either of these things. And so he's caught in the middle. And that this is an action film. It's just, that's just the genre, it's the trope that they're using. This could be a drama. It could be him, you know, overcoming financial burdens. It could be a sci-fi where he's, you know, fighting some alien creature. It could be a comedy. You know, you can apply it anywhere. It's human and universal at its core, and that's why it works. So, yes, I mean, violence is a thing that has to be considered in the realm of humanity and how much we focus on it, what it does to people. But that's any movie. I mean, if it has, you know, gratuitous sex or gratuitous violence or gratuitous cursing, or if it's anything that's just pointed to an extreme, it's how we learn. You know, extremes help bring us out of reality and force us to look at something that we would not normally look at in reality. And it allows us to learn, and that's why I love these movies knew more just because I'm an action fan. I love, you know, the choreography and, yes, a good headshot or two, maybe in the same head. But is that, you know, these movies try to, in their own small way, without being preachy, without being heavy-handed, they know what they're there for. They have, there is a bit of sense of, you know, self-understanding in these movies. But they try to teach you a little something about pain and about people and about humanity. And that's what the movies do best, and they do it in different genres with different tools and different elements and different focus and different styles of choreography and CGI or whatever it may be. But that's, I think these films know very well what they're there to do, and they accomplish it. And they just, they get in, they do it, they accomplish it, and leave. I mean, that's it. Kind of like a John Wick. Getting in there, getting the kills done, and just leaving.
He kills? Fun. So efficient.
Yes.
Well, before we go too long, I wanted to start to wind us down.
Okay.
And by doing that, I want to maybe, possibly, perhaps, perchance, I can do this forever.
I sense an edit coming here.
I have to edit earlier, but then people will never know. So did I edit? Who knows? We'll find out.
It's a mystery.
I'm curious, because we haven't done favorite moments in a long time, but I'm kind of interested in a movie that has raised the bar for cinematic violence. Kind of, if there was one thing that just really stood out to you, maybe besides the pencils. and then we'll hit final thoughts. So, Jason, was there anything that just really kind of captured this movie for you or made you say, yes, that was it?
You know, I think there's not a specific moment. I mean, there's some great moments in this movie, and we talked about a couple already. With the fight with Common is great. But I love the way this movie inside of itself creates John Wick as a myth. Like, whenever his name is spoken by another character, especially if he's not on screen, you get weird looks by people in the room. You get it's always very awkward because everyone knows that the boogeyman is coming. And so I think the opening scene for me was it just set that right tone. You've got, you know, the brother of the boss of the first one just sitting there going, I'm completely powerless to what's going to happen. So I'm going to drink my sorrows away and listen to the carnage go on around me. And so I think that whole scene was, it perfectly sets the tone of what I think this movie can be and where sort of that superhero aspect comes to it. Right. He literally is this, unstoppable force once he's after you.
Mr. Mark?
Gosh. So many good moments in this movie. You know, I definitely was at the time a very big Matrix nerd. I remember when the sequels were about to come out and my roommate and I were like, theorizing, like we were talking theory about like what everything means in the trailers and all this stuff. I mean, I was a Matrix nerd. I played the games, I watched the Animatrix, everything. So seeing Lawrence Fishburne and Keanu Reeves on screen again together was a really small but very cool moment, I think, for me. But in terms of the movie itself, outside of that, the humor. It's just wonderful. I love the scene with the sommelier and talking in, you know, veiled puns about, you know, wine.
Great scene.
Yeah, just wonderful scene. And to be able to reinvent the Bond and Q scene is difficult. It's not easy to do. And it's really not very complex how they did it. It's just kind of simple. And they knew exactly what kind of scene it was. There's very self-awareness about this movie. But, you know, there's a lot of humor in this movie. You know, you're not very good at retiring. I'm working on it. You know, like, they delight in the kind of ridiculousness. I'm working on it. When the guy shows up and he's like, oh, you're in Rome? Are you working? just to answer me one question. And like, I think he's going to ask, are you here for me? He's like, are you here for the Pope? The most untouchable man, certainly in Rome, if not the world. It's like, oh, John Wick's here. He must be here for the Pope. The Pope, you know. Oh my gosh, it was just, that was so funny. So there's a lot of those moments that are just, you know, again, that fight where they're walking in the silencers and they're just shooting into a crowd, but the crowd doesn't know it. I mean, it's just genius, and it's these little details that really make, that's what the movie is all about, really. That's what it's so good at, is the details. And there's humor in that, and it's just so much fun.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm thinking when I think of what I enjoyed about it, because it was subtle. You know, it's not like they're setting up jokes. They're not really.
No.
It's just when you have to, when the rules of your world cause tension in ways that are just socially awkward or whatever. Like, I really did like the scene when Common and Wick, I know his name is not Common. I feel like we keep calling him
Cassius.
Common. Yeah, Cassian. Yeah. So Cassian and Wick, I mean, even though it's predictable what's going to happen, like they, you know, they bust through the doors of the whatever the Rome Continental is.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly have to stop fighting.
Yeah.
And then they have a drink together.
Yeah.
And it's just
literal moments away from literally killing each other.
Yeah.
And now they're drinking together.
I mean, yeah, just, you know, having this devotion to something higher.
And the movie just the movie recognizes that how ridiculous that is, and they're okay with it. And they just let the characters sit in it, and that's something that takes an extraordinary amount of patience as far as filmmaking. And that's what makes it so enjoyable, is that they take the time to be patient, to let these things just play. Mm. They show it to you versus telling it to you. I mean, it's very well done, and it's so fun.
Well, I guess this is the part of the show where I would ask for your final thought. And honestly, I'm kind of swinging the doors wide open. So, Jason, what is this, like, the thing that you would leave people with about this film?
Wow.
I thought you were gone there. Yeah, I was like,
did you die? Did John Wick come for you?
Yeah. It would have been silently. Yeah.
Silent killer.
You know, I've enjoyed most of what we talked about. I think the thing that when I first walked out of the movie, it was, am I supposed to take the violence seriously? You know, and what you started our conversation off with, this idea of, oh, you got to go see these movies because you just shut your brain off. But a movie like this that builds its world so deeply and then is able to make such a human story, and what, I mean, part of the reason it's funny is because it's so fantastical. These kind of movies, we just need more of them. And I love that I feel like we're at an age in art, TV or movie where we truly do get some really amazing storytelling by people who truly love telling those stories. And a movie like this, where you know that so many involved put all of their passion into it, it's worth supporting, and it's worth being continuing to see these kind of movies and to talk about them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Agreed.
I guess, you know, my final thought is that it's interesting that, you know, following the kind of last decade and a half or two decades of action movies, there's kind of been that it sort of franchise that just kind of comes out of nowhere. It was Jason Bourne, obviously. It was the new revamped James Bond after that. The kind of all of a sudden explosion of good films from the Mission Impossible franchise. You know, the Fast and Furious franchise.
After The Rock.
The Rock entered and, you know, does what The Rock does and made everything better. I feel like, you know, I think it's obvious that John Wick is that it franchise for the moment. It doesn't seem like it has the kind of, you know, gravity or gravitas of some of those other films that I mentioned, but
until they have The Rock.
Until they had The Rock.
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
Oh, dear.
John Wick 3 with The Rock.
Actually, honestly.
Probably wouldn't be a good fit.
Honestly. The Rock doesn't seem necessarily like he would fit this universe, but someone who would make this universe amazing that I also have a man crush on is Idris Elba.
Oh yeah.
He would slide he would slot right into the John Wick universe.
Great.
Or even the Jonah Wick universe.
The Jonah Wick. Oh my gosh. So this episode will now be titled John Wick or Jonah Wick. My thought about that is he's the It franchise right now, and I think it's interesting that he's got so much to say if you kind of peek below the surface, because the tendency is, yes, there's a lot of flashy gunfire and choreographed fights, but I really feel like there's something to learn from the character just being able to, he's so human and he's so vulnerable in the fact that he's still this impervious fighter. I like that it's real in the sense of it's got a focus and a light touch on the human aspects of it. So I feel like that was there in parts in some of those other franchises that I mentioned, but definitely not there as prevalent as it is in John Wick. So I can't wait to see the next where they take that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I didn't bring this up earlier because, again, with a movie like this, anytime you make a spiritual connection when it's so lauded as a mindless film, it feels like you're stretching or it feels like you're trying too hard. But I do think, again, not trying to take us back to Sunday school, I do think there is something there that people can resonate with in chapter two when you talk about the marker or calling in the marker, because I don't think it's a stretch when they keep repeatedly talking about how, what's the bad guy's name? Santino. When Santino comes in and points out that he did something, we can call it giving John Wick a gift that allowed him to enter like a rebirth of his life. And there is a price to pay for that. An atonement, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And seeing that there is in this world that we have, that the writer has built, atonement is a thing. Like, you do something, you pay for it. Like, you don't get to do something without having to be called upon later by getting the marker. And by trying to avoid paying the price, things only get worse. Like, it is a very science. It's a very cause and effect. It's a very equal and opposite reaction. And I love the idea that that's not the world that we inhabit. That we live in a world where our life can be transformed by a gift that we can't pay back.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is nothing, like there's no amount of headshots that will justify this gift.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the fact that our belief system subverts something that people assume. I think the average person goes to this movie and they see this setup, the I did you a favor, you owe me a favor. I basically gave you your freedom, now you're still a slave to me. Like, I think people see that and they say, yeah, that's how things work.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But we live in a reality and we believe in a reality that says that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
There is one thing that is a free gift. So, and like I said, there's more nuance to that, but I wanted to put that out there because I didn't want anyone to say that I can't believe you didn't talk about the marker. I didn't talk about the thing. Mm-hmm. Because it was one of the first things I thought about after the running from like what you were created to do, and there's a lot there that we could unpack, but that's why I left it for the final thoughts, because I said I didn't want anyone. Also, it's like, you know, can't win either way. Catch 22.
Sure.
We can either talk about it and we can say we're trying to over spiritualize it, or we don't talk about it and they say, why didn't you mention it?
Yeah.
So hopefully that's something that if you want to unpack that more. Or you think that I'm way off base with using that or seeing that analogy there, then it would be an opportune time for you to go to our Facebook discussion group.
Yeah. Yes.
And we can talk about it there when this episode gets posted. But outside of that, I have really enjoyed this conversation. Yeah. And for a conversation that I think most people would assume would just be us talking about kill shots. Mm-hmm. Not only were we insanely hilarious, but
you should have seen the smug face on Fizz's face when he said that.
My arms thrown wide.
Yes,
inviting in criticism. But like I said, I think I'm glad that I don't think we had to try very hard to show that even in a movie that is just a popcorn action movie, that there is more. More to it. So
yeah,
I really enjoyed that. But I think, as I always say, great conversations happen because we have great guests. So I'm really glad that these two guys could join me, and I want you, the listeners, to be able to connect with them, either furthering the discussion or just following the work that they do. So Jason, how can people find you on the internet or follow anything that you do or be a part of what you're doing in life?
Okay, quickest part would be my blog is rindaria.com, and I can give you the link for the page, or I'm at rindaria on Twitter, which is a little world I played around with creating at one time. So I like for all things creative. It is, but yes. So for all things creative, I sort of use that as my launching pad. So that's where, or you know, what we do with the church and stuff is, you know, through Facebook and life here in Dallas.
Well, the next time I come and visit my dad in Dallas, mm-hmm. then we are playing Dungeons and Dragons. It's going to happen.
That's fantastic.
I'll bring my bag of dice.
I will gladly host at around our table. So.
Nerd! Sorry, somebody had to say it.
I'm so excited. I want to play D&D so bad.
Just kidding.
So, Mark, assuming that you're not offended by being a nerd, yes, how could those non-nerds follow you?
Oh, I'm a nerd in many other things. Star Trek, anybody? Let's go. Boldly, where no one has gone before.
Oh, man.
best thing, really, and I just want to emphasize this again, is to come and join the Real World Facebook discussion group. It's free to enter. You're welcome to come. It's a closed group, but you can enter and join us, and we have great discussions, and I try to spur a lot of people out of their comfort zones, maybe. But they also spur me out of mine, so I'm a regular contributor to Real World Theology. Doctor Who's coming up. I'm the episodic reviewing the series as it comes along. It's my favorite thing that I write. So if you really want to catch my personality and a lot of things I do, check me out there. And Real World all the way, baby.
Yeah. Real World all the way.
Yes, sir.
Actually, while you were doing that, I probably should have looked this thing up that I wanted to tell people about. And so instead of doing
I could stall if you'd
like. No. I'm stalling right now by talking about how I should have done it.
Oh.
So I
feel like my stalling would be better because I could talk about Captain Picard.
You could.
Let me tell you about our ship's captain.
I thought you were going to say our Lord and Savior.
And
I felt that coming too. Yeah.
Let me tell you about the ship's captain of life, Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
There are two things that I want to leave everyone with, and one is the normal thing. If you want to get a hold of me, if you want to follow me, talk to me, harass me, whatever, I'm really open to it. You can do that on Twitter at Fizzification. Or again, join the Facebook discussion group. Go to realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L worldtheology.com. But also, we have a lot of new ways for you to help us out. if you were interested in supporting the show in any way to help us, you know, get hosting, get a better website, get more content up, then we have begun connecting ways for you to do that. Just go to realworldtheology.com/support. And you can see what we currently have set up and a couple things that we're going to be doing soon in the future. So we're very excited about that. Check that out. Go to iTunes, review the show, help people find us. It's going to be great. Subscribe. That's what I want to say. Subscribe. Please subscribe. Mm-hmm. Subscribing is great. Because the more people that subscribe, the more people can find us, more conversations, they're better. I think I've said these things like every episode. So if you've ever listened to another episode, imagine me saying all that except saying it really awesome. And then ultimately...
I can't imagine that it is.
You can't imagine that? It's too hard. It's too hard?
Yeah.
I bet if Jonah Wick was here, he would have said it perfect. But for me, for Mark, for Jason, for yes. Jonah Wick...
Yes.
And for Real World Theology, like I said, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Boom! Headshot.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think I'm done.
you didn't sound like you were
silent
done.
Silent standoff there.
Well, I go ahead. No, really, you need to go.
Yes. I love this. Continue. I'm not going to say anything.
What you just did. All right, everyone quiet. Jason's going to talk.
Am I?
Go ahead.